12, Windchill 10 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Now, 11 minutes after 8, support for WGTD and the morning show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Jack Andrea, proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And the morning show comes your way in just 30 seconds. On this Veterans Day, I'm very, very pleased that we can talk about an incredibly powerful new book called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. This is really an extraordinary collection of photographs taken during the waning days, weeks and days of the Second World War. Photographs taken by and large by photographers of the U.S. Signal Corps of the U.S. Army. And the vast majority of these photographs, I believe, have not ever been widely seen by the public before. I suspect many of them have never been published before. And they are carefully chosen and carefully presented in a way that I found deeply moving and haunting. And I can't think of a better way to reflect on the meaning of this particular day than to thoughtfully take in this extraordinary book. It is the product not only of the courageous photographers who took these photographs in the first place, but also of two journalists and photojournalists who have lovingly crafted this book, Richard Kahan and my morning show guest, Mark Jacob, a former Metro editor at the Chicago Tribune and Sunday editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, and someone who has crafted a number of different books before this. And he was part of the Chicago Tribune's team that won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Explanatory Journalism. And I am very honored to speak with him about this book, again titled Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. Mark Jacob, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
So tell us, first of all, how this book came about. I mean, was it an idea that you and your co-author had, or did someone else have the idea that the world needed, in a sense, yet another book of painful images from World War II?
Right. If it was just another book about World War II, yeah, you're right, it could be skipped. Well, so let me just explain a little bit. So there are actually three co-authors, Richard Kahan, Michael Williams, and myself, Mark Jacob. And we often look for photo archives that are underexposed, that people have not paid much attention to. A previous book was about the Japanese incarceration during World War II, and there were great photos there. So generally, our MO is to look for underexposed photo archives and edit them in a modern, interesting way to make new points. And in this case, we decided that it might be interesting to look at the last year of the war, 1945, and we picked the U.S. Army Signal Corps because they were all over the globe, and so it really reflected the idea of a world war, of a total war. You know, there are photos from the Philippines, there are photos from Japan, there are photos from France, from Germany, from Burma, all over the place. And we decided to kind of edit them for looking for photos that people hadn't seen before, and we certainly found those. And we also wanted to, in a way, be a tribute to these soldier photographers who took them. Because, you know, it's so important for us to remember how bad war is so that we make really smart decisions about when we get into war and when it's necessary and when it's not.
Right. We read this book and we certainly have a sense of the terrible cost of war, and not just for those who are directly involved in the fighting, but also all those who are innocently caught in its path.
That was one of the things we found in World War II was... you know, and historians know this, but I don't know if the regular people do, that it was such a total war for civilians, too, that there were more civilian casualties than, you know, than combatants, and unlike a lot of the previous wars.
Right. Before we talk about some of the extraordinary photographs that are part of this book, I think we should talk about those so-called soldier photographers whose work is captured here. And find out a little bit more about who they were and the way in which they went about capturing images like those that are included in this book. If I understand correctly from the introduction, the photographic unit of the U.S. Signal Corps was actually created during the First World War. Is that right?
I believe so, yes. And so when the Second World War broke out, you know, and people were drafted, people volunteered, you could volunteer to be in the Signal Corps, and you could try to become a photographer. And most of the people who became photographers in the Army Signal Corps during World War II were not professional photographers. A few were. One guy, for example, Clifford Bell, was a clerk at a San Antonio camera store. He ended up... finding his comrade, another photographer, dead in an Italian street after a German strafing. So these people who came from just regular life were suddenly plunged into complete horror. Another really interesting photographer that we highlight in the book is named Arthur Hertz. He was born a Jew in Germany, and as Hitler rose to power, his family fled first to Italy, and Arthur Hertz ended up in Rochester, New York. And he ended up volunteering in the U.S. Army, and he came back over in the Army Signal Corps and was highly valued because he spoke German, and which was super important. Another photographer, most photographers also, when they left after the war, did not go into photography. They went back to the job they had or into some other career. One of them, Roland Oxton, won a Pulitzer Prize with the Boston Herald American in the 1970s, but that was kind of the exception, not the rule.
What can you tell us about the training that these men received in order to do this work? And did their training in any respect parallel the kind of basic training that a more typical member of the military would receive?
Sure. They went through all the basic training that everyone else did. And then they specialized as everyone else did. You know, just like some were sent to, you know, to work on, you know, with mortars, or some were going to be working on artillery fire, these guys were doing camera work. And they were trained in both movies and still cameras. They used speed graphics. If you see old movies, you've seen speed graphics. Those are the big kind of press photographer cameras, you know, pretty cumbersome, and you put in one negative in a cartridge at a time and take the picture and take it out and put another one in. So, you know, it's not like an iPhone clicking, you know, 10 pictures in 10 seconds. It's very difficult. But anyway, so they were trained in both movies and still photography, and then chose a specialty. And then they were sent off to various places. They had extraordinary freedom compared to the regular GI, though. In Europe, for example, Eisenhower gave all the photographers what they called a blue pass. It meant they could go anywhere. And so they would go from, you know, battle scene to battle scene and wherever they thought the action was. And my co-authors and I were talking about this, and it must have been way more dangerous duty than being a regular GI, because you know, as you would well know, even soldiers who fought in really tough battles were in battle for usually for a few weeks and then had months and months of downtime. These photographers were just going to where the action was all the time. And so another thing about that is you couldn't carry a sidearm and a camera at the same time and use both. So often they just had to choose between the two. They had sidearms, but they often kept them holstered while they were taking pictures. It was difficult to take action shots because a lot of the fighting was at night, and because of the fact that when things got really hairy, they had to, you know, grab a gun and save their lives, frankly.
Wow. In the introduction, you make reference to the fact that I think there's about 250 photographs in this book, and that largely they emanate from the work of 10 signal photographic companies. Can you tell us anything about what that means? What would a single signal photographic company consist of? I mean,
yeah, I would. I'm not sure I'd get the numbers right as far as how many people were in them, but they were separate units and they had separate equipment. They had also had separate newspapers. They had like newsletter bulletin type newsletters that they put out, which really were helpful when we were producing the book because we could understand which photographer was where and what dangers they had faced. They operated in a really interesting way. You know, another thing that people who just know photography from iPhones don't realize is that you had to develop film back in those days, and you had to print it in dark rooms. And they had a rolling dark room on a trailer that they took behind a Jeep wherever they went. And so there's a picture in the book that shows one of them. It's just a, you know, small trailer enclosed that is in effect their dark room because they're developing and printing pictures on the run in the midst of battle.
Oh, I think that's one of the hardest things for us to sort of wrap our minds around, especially in the age in which we now live, in which photography is sort of part of just about all of our lives all day long, potentially. And we take images and create them and send them, share them with the greatest of ease. And it's really important for us to understand that it was a completely different world in 1945. And for anybody taking photographs, but particularly for anybody taking photographs under these kind of conditions.
Right. Well, here's an example of how cumbersome the equipment was and why there were special challenges there. There's a guy named Harold Roberts, and he was a photographer. He was one of the first into Buchenwald, the Nazi camp, not prisoner of war camp. It was actually a slave labor and camp where they held Jews. So, and many died there. And so he was one of the first photographers in, and he's taking a picture of this Soviet slave laborer pointing at a SS guard, and he's angrily pointing at him, and he's showing, you know, he's saying, this is the guy who brutalized everyone. And it's a really terrific photo, and it's in the book. And we found out as we were putting the book together that Roberts is dead now, but his wife tells a story about how he really hated that picture. It made him angry. And the reason was that he took that picture of the guy waving his finger, and he took the photo negative cartridge out, and he was changing cartridges so he could take another picture. And before he could get the other film in, the prisoner punched the SS guard in the face, just smacked him. And it was and Roberts always felt like that was the greatest picture he could have taken in World War II, and he missed it.
There's also an interesting moment in the book where a photographer is quoted as saying that he could have captured a certain picture, which I think of prisoners shortly before they were to be executed. I mean, they have less than a half hour to live, although they perhaps don't.
Not to be executed, more than I think they were like starving to death.
Oh, I see.
You know,
okay.
I mean, a lot of times, when the Allies came in, and were liberating these camps, these people were just on death's door.
Right.
And some of them, they were the Americans were able to save, and some of them they were not.
Right, exactly. Thank you for correcting my memory. But in this case, the photographer is quoted as saying that part of me, probably the photographer part of me, really wanted to capture that scene, a photograph of those faces, and he just could not bring himself to do so and lowered his camera. And that's kind of an intriguing moment in the book, because it reminds us that these photographers, in addition to facing danger at nearly every hand, nearly every day, were also confronted with sometimes, I'm sure, very difficult choices about whether or not a given image should be captured or not, or in what way.
You know, interestingly, the fact that most of them were not professional photographers might have worked to allow them to capture more humanity in some ways. You know, they were just not as used to seeing kind of death and destruction as a professional photographer might have seen, professional news photographer at least. And a lot of the most intriguing pictures of the book and most kind of passionate pictures in the book show civilians and how they were and them struggling through the war. So, and the fact that these were just regular guys thrust into the war may have actually worked to the benefit of us, you know, so many years later looking at these pictures.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Mark Jacob, who is one of the co-authors of an incredible book, so moving, titled Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. This book is a collection of some 250 photographs taken by photographic units of the U.S. Signal Corps of the U.S. Army. All of these images are from 1945, the last year of World War II, and presented in chronological order. And we'll talk about some of those other matters in terms of the presentation of these photographs in just a couple of minutes. Mark Jacob, I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about where you found these images and what kind of repository that we are talking about. And I'm also, of course, very interested to know a little more about what went into the process of choosing which photographs to include in this book.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. The National Archives is one of the greatest institutions I've ever worked with. The professionals there just take such great care, and that's where all these photos are housed, in the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. And so we went and went through them. Now, one of the things that makes this book special and different is that we rescanned all the negatives. We went through the pictures, picked the ones we wanted, and rescanned the negatives, you know, using modern equipment, to where even the pictures, the few pictures that were widely seen back in the day, look so much better now, that because, you know, these are just these big 4x5 negatives that had a lot of photo information, but they needed to be scanned properly. Mm. And so instead of just printed in an old-fashioned way. So they look great, and they just pop off the page in a way that I'm just so thrilled with how the book looks technically.
Right.
And the odd thing about it, Greg, is that when I think about the book, I think it's a beautiful book, and that's very odd, because it's also an ugly book. I mean, it shows ugliness. It shows, you know, the worst moments of humanity, but it also presents it. It also shows interesting things that are not. I don't want anyone to think that this is just a nonstop horror show. It's not. It does have some terrible images, but it also has some fascinating images about other parts of the war. For example, there's one of my favorite pictures that shows a British guy on a bicycle demonstrating to other soldiers who have lost limbs how to ride a bicycle.
Yes. That jumped out at me. I appreciated so much that was there. And certain other photos, I wouldn't exactly call them moments of levity, but moments maybe of just lightness.
Right,
that we really welcome.
And showing the whole picture, you know, and we really looked for unusual images. And the truth is, at the time, I mean, it can't be missed that these Army photographers were taking pictures that would sometimes be used for propaganda, for war propaganda. So it wasn't like some of the pictures that are in the book you would have never seen in 1945 or 1946 or 1947. You just wouldn't have seen them. There's a picture of, you may have noticed the picture of the dead horse along the road in Germany with
yes.
the villagers are picking off parts of it to eat because they're so desperately hungry. That's the kind of picture that I don't think you would have seen at the time. And even the Japanese occupation pictures, pictures of, you know, GIs after the war ended in occupied Japan, military censors would not allow pictures of GIs with Japanese women to be published because they thought it was bad for morale back home. So there were a lot of kind of censorship rules followed at the time that we're not bound by now, and that's why I think we can edit the pictures in a lot more interesting way.
Right. Before we talk about more of the choices, I'm curious to know how many photographs are we talking about? I mean, just how large a treasure trove of photographs of the Second World War and maybe even specifically of 1945, how many images are we talking about that the two of you searched through? And how are they organized and stored there?
They're about 100,000 from 1945 alone.
Wow.
Maybe hundreds of thousands from the war in total. That's just the U.S. Signal Corps, U.S. Army Signal Corps. There were separate Marine units and Navy units who took pictures, and the Air U.S. Air Corps too. And there also were some media photographers too, from Time and New York Times, etc., who were allowed in too. So there are a lot of photos, no doubt of, as far as how you find the photos, a lot of them are printed at the National Archives, and they're organized. Now they're organized in ways you just have to, it helps to have been there before and to understand how they're organized. But the archives people are super careful about the things. They won't just give them to anyone at any time, and you sure as heck can't take them out of the building. But they would bring negatives, and we could scan them in and scan them, to real high definition to where right. they just look great.
Your book contains very helpful, illuminating captions of nearly every image. Is that information something that was just already there at the National Archives, or in any? Are there any instances in which you and your co-authors had to seek out more information about exactly what was being shown in this photograph, or to give it proper context?
No, I'm glad you asked that question. No, that's all new material. From doing a lot of research. The thing about it, one of the downsides of these photographers being mostly, non-professional photographers, at least when they started out, is that they wrote pretty terrible captions. The captions misspell a lot of names. They get a lot of things wrong, and so we had to kind of investigate a lot. There was one case where they had the name of a Russian general. There's a picture in the book of a Russian general meeting up with an American just near the end of the war when they met up in Germany. The Russians coming from the east and the Americans from the west. And they had the Russian general's name just mangled, and we couldn't figure out what it was. And so I sent emails out to 10 Russian history scholars in the United States and asking, who the heck is this guy? And got answers or guesses from three, and one of them sent it on to a diplomat in Europe who sent it on to Medvedev University in Moscow, and their history department identified the general for us. So that was helpful. In another case, this is maybe one of my favorite pictures in the book, is this stunning image of these Chinese relatives dressed in black, and they're standing in the Philippines. At their feet are the skulls and bones of their relatives, who are the diplomatic corps, the Chinese diplomatic corps in the Philippines when the Japanese invaded. The Japanese executed all of them. And they didn't learn until after the war that they were dead, but they suspected it. And we tracked down the daughter of the consul general who was killed, the guy who led the consulate there. She's in New York now. She was in the publishing industry. She was not in the picture, nor was her mom. They had already left for the United States, but when we sent her the picture, she said, I can identify everyone who's in that picture, which was sure more information than we had before.
Wow.
And she also said she had never seen the picture before. And I said, is your father's remains in the picture? And she says, I assume they are.
Wow.
So it was kind of amazing that she was seeing this picture for the first time 75 or 80 years later.
How difficult was it to ultimately make the choices that you did in terms of the 250 images that are captured here, I mean, that are contained in your book? I'm just guessing that it had to be a rather overwhelming challenge on a couple of different levels, with so much to draw upon, and you probably wished that there could be 10 volumes of images in some ways.
You know, we had a lot of discussions about that, because obviously you could do books and books on the Holocaust, and there are many pictures of that, but it felt better to us to do, you know, 10 really great photographs than to do 100 great photographs. It seemed right, and we really aimed for not being repetitive and for going to different theaters of the war and showing both civilians and GIs. And so we looked for variety. I mean, we aim for, with a book like this, you really want to create a book that you can page through, and you're not going to like just stop because you've seen that picture already. And in this book, you know, you'll go to one page and you've got German villagers being forced to kind of rebury the dead, because back when the war ended, the Americans wanted to make sure that the regular German civilian took responsibility for what they had allowed to happen in their country. And so they did make them, you know, face up to it, visit death camps, etc. But if you go to that, then you go to the next picture, and it's a suspected fascist collaborator in the middle of an Italian town square. You know, and then you go immediately to to a Philippine scene where an American GI is getting a saline solution because he's dehydrated, and there's a Filipino guerrilla fighter with a big nasty gun. Then you go, I'm just paging through the book now describing it. Then you go to a mom and her daughter returning to the Aleutian Islands after they had to flee because they were worried about the Japanese invading Alaska and the Aleutians.
It really gives us a sense that this was a world war in every sense. I mean, that nearly every corner of the globe was caught up in this terrible conflict, and these photographs really give us a sense of that. And I do applaud you for managing to achieve that. I mean, I think even certain books about World War II that are, in a sense, more kind of historical tomes don't always manage to convey that to us as powerfully as your book does. How about the choice? Go ahead.
No, thank you for that. And, I think that one explain also that why we call the book Aftershock and what our theme was. We really wanted to, we picked 1945. You know, obviously, it's a giant war. There are so many pictures taken. You just couldn't do just a general book. That would make no sense, you know, at this point. So we wanted to narrow it. And so we went to 1945 and viewed that as a time when the American army was, you know, recapturing territory and ending the war, winning the war. And it was kind of an inventory of how horrible these years of total war had been. I mean, you'll see, you know, Greg, in the book there are pictures of devastated European cities. I mean, just shockingly devastated cities. And, you know, and you see that, you see death camps, you see these all these desperate people. And this was a time when the whole world was realized just how hideous and horrible this war had been, and so it was an aftershock. Mm-hmm. And you know, the picture on the cover of the book is a guy named a PFC named Jack Pulliam from Pennsylvania, and I'll just describe it. But if you see the picture, I don't think you'll ever forget it. It's he's got this look in his eyes like he's like it's a 1,000-mile stare. It's just it's like he's seen horrible things, because he has. His story, and we were able to track down his family. Jack Pulliam himself is gone, but his family told us, shared like a 20-page memoir of his time in the service with us, which was just terrific. He's a great story. He was captured in the Battle of the Bulge on his 20th birthday. He was taken to Germany and put into slave labor, managed to escape, hid in a house. The German officers came in, and he killed the German officer to avoid being recaptured, and then was hiding in a fruit cellar when the Americans came and found him. And he was still wearing, the picture in the book shows him with this, this exhausted look on his face, these eyes that almost just are haunting eyes. And he's wearing the German officer's cap, the officer he killed. And that, we just felt like that was the perfect image just to say, to say both aftershock, this, the shock of this horrible thing that we'd been through, and how it affects human beings.
Right. And I think for a lot of us who are, thankfully, viewing all of this from a safe distance in terms of years elapsed, I think we sometimes think of 1945 as, in a sense, the best year of that war. I mean, because it's the year that it ended, and that warfare slowly but surely began to evaporate, and eventually, in a sense, peace took its place. But in fact, 1945 was just, in a sense, a different kind of terrible. And,
right. It was the dawning of the atomic age, for example.
Right. Well, and just the widespread suffering of all kinds of people left in the wake of this brutal war. I mean, the suffering didn't end. It, in a sense, it just sort of changed. And I think your book does a marvelous job of helping us understand the ordeal that so many people experienced in 1945, if you were fortunate enough to survive to 1945.
Right.
Another choice that you make that I think is laudable, but I'd like to understand more about it, is the fact that these photographs are presented in chronological order. I neglected to see whether or not it's nearly every single day of the year represented, but they are presented in chronological order. Why did you and your co-authors feel that was important to do?
Well, that was, we didn't have to do that, but I think when you're telling kind of a logical kind of story, when you're trying to create a narrative of the world of a world war winding down, it was important to show, early on in the book, you see some aftermath of battle scenes, and there's a picture here of them teaching Americans how to use flamethrowers. There's there's refugees leaving. I feel like in a way, if you page through it, you do get the whole year in a kind of a story. You get it winding down, and that by the end of the year, there's a picture of black marketeers working in a Vienna square. There's orphans and other children being shipped off to a safer place where there's food. I think it tells a story, being chronological. It didn't have to be, but that was just a choice we made. And we made a lot of choices like that. We also, you probably also noticed that with every image is full frame, including all the writing on the edges of the images.
I appreciate that so much, and I think one of the reasons I think that's a wonderful choice is because, in a sense, we get a more vivid, visceral sense that a human being took this picture, and somehow they are part of that story because we see everything, including the handwritten caption that might or might not be around the frame of the photo itself.
Greg, do you mind if I steal that explanation? Because I think that's a terrific one. I think ours was a little simpler than that, but although yours is great, and we just wanted it to be evidence. We just viewed it as evidence, and so we wanted to present it in a way that wasn't too manipulative, and did kind of present each picture as an artifact. Mm. So that was the choice there.
We're speaking with Mark Jacob, and we're speaking about the book he co-authored called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. And in our last few minutes, I want to talk about a couple of photographs that reached out to me very powerfully, and you've already mentioned a couple of them. But I just want to mention a couple of others, and it sounds like you have the book close at hand.
Yes.
Okay. Right around page 70, I believe, is a very striking photograph of two German women who are fleeing, and they are fleeing on some kind of odd vehicle that I have never really seen before. But it's such a striking image, and I wonder if you could describe it to our listeners and what we see in this intriguing photograph.
Well, it's what they call a runabout, you know, which is they called it at the time gasoline-powered, you know, and it's three wheels, you know. And in fact, some foreign countries, you see vehicles like that today. I was in Peru last year, and there were vehicles like that that were, in effect, used as cabs. But it's got one wheel in the front, and it's got, you know, two in the back. And this one, these two women who are kind of dressed fairly properly with, you know, boots and everything and hats, and one of them's driving it, and the other one is riding behind her. And as a photograph, it's really well composed because they're in focus and the city behind them is not. But it just has this great sense of motion. They are fleeing the city of Krefeld in Germany after it was captured by the U.S. 9th Army. Krefeld was this wonderful, kind of rich city in the German Empire. It was known as the Velvet and Silk City back in the 1800s because of its textile industry. It was bombed by the Allies about 200 times, and more than 2,000 civilians were killed in those bombings. So it was the town had just been wrecked by this. And as the Americans come in, these two women are fleeing in their runabout. I like that picture too.
It's fascinating, and of course, it's one of many images that represent refugees on the run, and also represent something that I think in the introductory essay is called "Life Amid the Rubble," which is, of course, so much of what 1945 was all about. In fact, right around there in the book, maybe a page later, is one of the most heartbreaking yet also, in a sense, beautiful images, which is of the ruins of Cologne. This is the kind of thing where it is a photograph that is almost seems to be from the air, and it is at some distance, so we see a wide swath of the city. But the extraordinary clarity allows us to take in this image and to take in just how devastated this city is at this point in time.
Well, this is a really good example of a photo that has never looked better than in this book. You know, because the negative is rescanned and the clarity is true, but it's as you can see, it's like it's just as far as your eye can see, there are half destroyed buildings. It's like it's the bombing campaigns, both in against Japan and against Germany, were just amazing. That picture is paired with one of the cathedral at Cologne. I think it's pretty clear that the Allies tried to avoid destroying the cathedral, which was started in, you know, the 13th century, and it did survive. It was despite almost everything around it being destroyed.
Right. Earlier in the interview, you mentioned what's probably one of the, in a sense, ugliest or most, you know, immediately disturbing images, which is of the corpse of a horse in the gutter of a street, and there are civilians gathered around it, desperately hungry, and that's a hard image to see. I think the next page is a photograph of two 14-year-old German boys who had been captured by the Allies, and these would be 14-year-old boys that had been, in a sense, pressed into military service as Germany became ever more desperate in the waning weeks of the war. That's a hard photograph to look at as well.
Oh, I know, and they're just baby-faced kids.
Absolutely.
You know, and one of them, and we point out in the text, in the caption, that one of the kids even has his overcoat misbuttoned. So I don't know whether they got those uniforms just just the day or two before. And this was when the entire Nazi empire was collapsing. And so they were just going in and just grabbing kids and putting uniforms on them and sending them out there. And I think that it's an odd thing because you get the sense that the Americans who came and were conquering Germany had some sympathy for the civilians, but at the same time they realized, you know, just how much damage to the entire world, Hitler's madness had created. And they were about to see more. The pictures of those kids comes chronologically before they get to Dachau and other camps like that. It's going to get a lot worse.
I also, I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, but I did not know of something else that is a truly horrific moment from 1945 until I read your book, and that is something that I think is known as the Gardelegen Massacre, which occurred apparently in April of 1945, and there is a heartbreaking image from the aftermath of that. Just explain to our listeners, especially for any who, like me, did not know about this terrible moment.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the. You have the page.
Right around page 108.
Right, Gardelegen was. The sad thing about it wasn't really unique. That's the thing about it is that this kind of thing was happening. By this time in the war, the Germans were fleeing, but they were often taking their slave laborers and other prisoners with them because they didn't want all the horribleness they had done to be exposed. And Gardelegen is in northern Germany, and it was the Nazis, as they were fleeing, they just couldn't feed them anymore. They could barely feed themselves. So they took all these prisoners into this large barn, and then they locked the barn and set a fire. And many of them burned to death, and the ones who desperately clawed under the bottom of the barn to try to dig their way out were shot when they got out. So more than 1,000 bodies were discovered in the barn and nearby. And it was just this, and this image is one of the toughest in the book, I'd have to say, because it's a human turned to ash, is what it is.
Right.
And you can recognize that it was a person. And I don't know that image was ever published at the time. In fact, I'd never seen it before until we started doing the research for the book. But this is just this depravity. And this leads me to another story. We have time, it's pretty short. But there was another case. We have a woman in the book named Amalie Mary Reichman, and she was this Jewish woman, slave laborer, who was also taken on the run with the Germans when they were trying to kind of hide what that had happened. And finally, when they ran out of food and they ran out of time, the Germans would just abandon their half-starving prisoners. And they abandoned her and others in another barn, and the Americans advanced quickly enough to where a medical unit got to that barn and found all the, like 100 women starving to death in the barn and saved many of them. And coincidentally, the lead doctor of that medical unit was a guy named Aaron Cahan, and he's the father of one of our co-authors, Richard Cahan.
Wow.
Yeah, my friend Rich, who I worked on the book with, it's the story he's always told me, that his dad in the military just discovered this barn full of starving women, and they, you know, quickly tried to get them. They couldn't feed them too fast because, as you know, if you do that, they would, you know, they wouldn't be able to hold down the food, but they managed to save many of them. And this woman who we have a picture of, she went to the National Archives to try to find pictures a few years ago, and she ran across the pictures in our book she saw for the first time then.
Wow. Just a couple others that I want to mention. On page 125 of your book is a striking image from Italy, and this is of what amounts to a photographic wall, and it brings to mind what people saw in the heart of Manhattan in the wake of 9/11, where people would post photographs of loved ones who were missing. And here it is, 1945 in Italy, and we have loved ones doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it was, well, as you know, Mussolini and his fascists were, they would kidnap people and they'd never be seen again. And so there were a lot of missing, and you know, as the war is ending and the Allies are, you know, recapturing Italy, yes, these walls spread up, and it's just, mothers and fathers putting pictures up, have you seen my son or my daughter? And that became this practice. I mean, it started in Bologna and Bologna, and then spread to other cities in Italy. Hmm. And it does. It did. When I first saw the picture, I thought the same thing. It reminded me of 9/11.
Fascinating. I am also struck by a photograph from page 134, which is a photograph of a wedding being conducted by a Mormon chaplain. And this is a wedding between, I believe, two prisoners.
Well, one of them was a lieutenant in the Japanese army, and the other was a nurse in Okinawa. Yes, both Japanese. And this is kind of unusual. And it goes to the point we were discussing earlier about how the book isn't just nonstop horrors. There are moments of relief. And this was actually the AP, the Associated Press, wrote about it at the time, and so that's why we have good detail on it. But so this Japanese, the Okinawa was, the Japanese were fighting to the last man, and they would sometimes hide in caves and this and that. And this lieutenant, when he saw the cause was lost, kind of hid in a cave and had met a girl, and they hid together, and finally he was captured. And he explained to them that they wanted to get married, and so the Americans actually married had a wedding ceremony, and it's an interesting picture. It also shows they have an accordion they're playing to play the wedding music, and in the background you see a bunch of American GIs kind of attending and watching it. Mm. But is that something you'd ever seen before? It certainly wasn't something I'd ever seen.
Not at all, and. One more moment from 1945, and maybe a gratifying moment of hope amidst so much horror. Well, overall, I must say that this book really exceeded my expectations. I mean, I did not expect it to be as revelatory as it is, and I hope that you and your co-authors feel good about how it finally took shape.
Well, we have pretty high standards, and we're not always happy with things, but frankly, we're thrilled with this book. We think it turned out really well, and I hope the readers will feel that way, too.
The title again is Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers, and one of the co-authors, Mark Jacob. Mark Jacob, I was really privileged to speak with you today. I commend you and your co-authors for doing a really marvelous job with such an important project, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about it on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you will hear the interview which I was privileged to record with Andrea Shambly, the widow of John McNamara, a journalist who was one of five employees of the Annapolis Capital Gazette who were gunned down in a mass shooting in the summer of last year. At the time of his tragic death, McNamara was hard at work on A Labor of Love, a book about basketball in Washington, D.C., the history of it. And Andrea Shambly took the enormous resources that he had amassed over a decade or more and was able to finish the book that her husband had begun, a book titled The Capital of Basketball, A History of D.C. Area High School Hoops. You'll hear my conversation with her tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. We remind you that the Morning Show is now available as a podcast on all the major podcast providers, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast.